Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you always for joining me and having the opportunity to have in-depth conversations that really are empowering for you. In fact, that's the real purpose of this show, is to empower you with truthful information so you can make informed decisions regarding yourself, your health, the health of your loved ones, and just trying to stay aware, which is so important these days. So much information coming into us, and you need to find trusted sources, and I trust you'll find my source of information, a trusted source. If you're listening for the very first time, welcome to my community. Please, if you'd like to get the archived shows, go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. Just like me there. I also can send these archive shows directly to you, so you can go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com. And by the way, I have a second program on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time called The Love Code. And this is all about our spiritual evolution, our spiritual growth, spiritual healing, and it's also incredibly uplifting, transforming. And I hope you'll be listening in and joining me and taking advantage of the great wisdom that my guests have to share every Saturday at 11 a.m. And we're going to talk about the wisdom that my guest has to share today. We're talking about a topic that is really relevant for all of the men listening, but as we know, it's the women who usually support and help their men. So I'm glad everyone's listening, because we're going to be talking about surviving prostate cancer without surgery, drugs, and radiation, which is a powerful topic, and my guest who's going to be sharing this is Peter Starr. So let me just say a little bit about Peter. Peter Starr had a long and eclectic career in the entertainment business, but his entertainment career came to a screeching halt in June 2004 when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Since then, he has concentrated on learning about restoring his own health while reversing his disease. His journey took him to 8 countries on 3 continents, where he learned from and interviewed 56 doctors and other health practitioners and researchers. This intense schooling and its practical application led to the production of the landmark documentary, Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, or Radiation, which is being shown in shortened form on PBS television networks. So, having said that, and what a courageous man and dedicated to the healing of his own challenge, but also now being able to help people, you know, millions of people worldwide. It's my pleasure to welcome Peter Starr to the show. So hello.
Thank you.
And welcome, Peter.
Hello and thank you. You didn't say anything about my weird sense of humor, so that's probably good.
Well, I thought I'd leave it for everyone else to find out for themselves. You know, we'll keep them online before they, you know, might find other things to do. So keep them engaged. Well, now that we're warned, we'll be ready for it. Peter, I always like to start by asking my guests their own personal journey. So obviously, something happened for you that was a life-changing experience, profound life-changing experience. So tell us a little bit what led up to this whole diagnosis and what, yeah, your journey with prostate healing. I like to call it prostate healing, prostate cancer healing.
Well, it's the interesting part is the fact that, like most men at that age, I was diagnosed when I was 61. I led an incredibly active life. I was a stunt person in the movies for 10 years prior to this. And I'd had a really bad accident in 1999. And that had put me off work for about 9 months. And 3 years later, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And the recovery from the broken leg that I had, it was broken in 5 different places, took so long and gave me a lot of time to think, but it didn't give me enough time to understand the kind of life that I was leading was at some point going to lead up to some sort of chronic disease. And I was living a pretty wild life, actually, to be quite honest. It was that sudden stop with the accident led me to think, but it didn't lead me enough to think to change my life. That I learned when the doctor first said, you've got prostate cancer. And that's when the hammer hit the anvil and it got my attention, as it would and does just about every man. In fact, most of the phone calls I get for consultations are from men that are absolutely panicked because their doctors told them they got prostate cancer and they're going to have to do this and that and the other, and they're totally freaked out. And that's how I was. So I relate totally. Prior to that, I mean, I had a pretty good life in the entertainment business and living in Los Angeles and being on radio and television and in a lot of movies and so on. I never thought I would ever get cancer. It just didn't enter my lexicon at all at any time. And so it came as an utter shock. But what it did do, when I realized what the significance of what the doctor was telling me, and he said it in a very unfriendly way. His bedside manner was very Neanderthal. He said, yep, you've got cancer. I want you to read this book by Patrick Walsh and then come back and see me, and we'll tell you what we're going to do. Well, I never read the book by Patrick Walsh immediately. I found a different book, which I read, and then I read another book and another book and another book. And I finally did get around to reading Patrick Walsh's book. But what I learned very quickly was that what the doctor was actually telling me was only a part of the story, and it was a part of the story that fitted his narrative in terms of getting me to do his treatment. In other words, if I didn't do his treatment, he didn't make any money. If I went off and did treatment B or treatment C, the urologist that diagnosed me didn't make any money. It's only if he did surgery that he would make money. And once I learned that, and once I'd learned from the second opinion from another urologist that he wasn't about, the second urologist was not about to tell me anything different than I'd already heard from the first urologist. It was like being in a club. And then I find later out that they both serve on the same board of directors and they both play at the same golf club, et cetera, et cetera. It was a club that wasn't about to tell me anything different. They taught me nothing about what I've learned in the 16 years since. And I learned it pretty much by getting out there and digging and talking to other doctors and talking to other patients. And it's been an educational process that's still going on to this day. I still learn from what I talk to patients and doctors. They all have something different to say. Obviously, at some point, you come to a decision about what you're going to do, and I certainly did, and it wasn't what that doctor wanted me to do. And I set about learning about how to turn my life around and understand what the disease is about and understand that the tumor and the cancer is the end result of a disease process, not the beginning. And if you don't cure or rectify the problems that precede the tumor, then there will be another tumor after that and another tumor after that. As happens, even when you've had your prostate removed, it does not mean that the cancer is not going to come back. And when I learned all of that, I said, okay, I don't need to do that treatment. I need to look into everything else that's going on in the world. And that's how I started producing the documentary that was eventually on PBS in a shortened form. The full documentary is an hour and 40 minutes. And then more recently, I updated my entire knowledge by writing a book called Prostate Cancer, Why We Get It, What to Do About It, which has just been released. And it's available now through our website, although it's not available through Amazon or any of those places yet. We're still trying to negotiate a deal with Amazon that makes some sense. And that's really about how I came about to the disease. What happened after the diagnosis is actually where the story really starts. Because anybody can get prostate cancer if they live the kind of Western diet and lifestyle that all of us, certainly where you are in Australia, it's very high there. It's very high in America. It's very high in England. It's exceptionally high in Sweden, believe it or not. Very, very high in Switzerland. Pretty high in Germany. And then you look at other countries around the world that do not live our diet and lifestyle, have much less incidences of prostate cancer. And that has to be the first place we look at in terms of learning what we do and where we go from here. There's a lot more science than that, but that is where it all starts, looking at why other people don't get it. Why did I get it? Why is that guy down the street getting it? You know, why is this guy getting it and dying from it immediately or very quickly, whereas other people get it and don't die from it? All of those things need to be learned to understand what options are available to you before you decide on a particular course of action, a course of treatment.
So let's start with the first question I have is, how do they diagnose you? What were there symptoms that you had that led you to go to the doctor?
No, in fact, there were no symptoms. I went for a regular annual checkup, which I needed to do for my Screen Actors Guild stunt membership thing that we have to do to get on our medical plan. And my PSA was 1.2, which it had been for many months. And I had PSAs done about every year for the last 5 or 6 years. It hadn't changed. It was still at 1.2, which is nothing to be concerned about, generally speaking, if all you look at is the PSA. And then he did a digital rectal exam, and he said, you know, I don't like the feel of that. I want you to go see the urologist. So I trucked off to see the urologist, and he did a digital rectal exam. He said, yeah, I don't like the feel of that either. We're going to do a biopsy. Now, at this point, nobody had asked me a single thing about, what do you think, you know, about should we do a biopsy? Are you okay with a biopsy? Because I knew nothing about what a biopsy was. I was totally ignorant. And when I went along for the biopsy, and they put a needle, a one and a half millimeter diameter needle into the prostate, anywhere from 10 to 18 times, going in through the rectum, they do give you some sort of anesthetic, but it's very local and it's not very good. And at the end of it, you bleed like you wouldn't believe it. For the next few days, you're urinating blood and you're defecating blood. Because of what they do. And then they tell you when they've examined it, oh, yes, you've got cancer. It's a Gleason score or whatever it is. Mine happened to be 7, 4 plus 3. And therefore, you have to have surgery, like right now. You know, you're going to die if you don't have surgery now. And, of course, that puts the fear of God into you and the fear of death into you for sure. And for the most part, it is filling into the scenario of what needs to happen to get you into that surgery, for that surgery which is going to make the doctor a lot of money and keep the system going. Most men do not question that. In fact, 70% of all men that have surgery make the decision to have the surgery within 48 hours of the diagnosis. So what that means is they don't ask any questions. They don't look beyond what that doctor's saying. They don't go for a second, third, or fourth opinion. And yet, prostate surgery is major surgery. It's not as light as they make it out to be. Yes, they have a sort of a light version, which is the Da Vinci robotic surgery. But as we've learned now, the side effects from the Da Vinci robotic surgery are pretty much identical to those from the radical prostatectomy, which is where they actually open up the abdomen, and the side effects are about the same. The return of cancer is about the same, and the side effects of impotence, incontinence is about the same. So the only thing that is good, you get a faster recovery, and you don't have a big scar down the middle of your abdomen. You've got three little scars. But surgery is major surgery by any other means, and people do die during surgery. So I'd have to take all that into consideration along with everything else that I learned before I decided what to do. But the key issue here is, when I told you that the PSA score was 1.2, if you're 61 years of age and your PSA is normally beneath 4, then the doctor that takes the PSA test probably wouldn't question it. When in fact, about 30% of men with prostate cancer have a PSA below what's considered to be the norm of 4. Mm-hmm. Now, we can get into the norm of 4. That was totally arbitrary on so many levels. But the fact that I had a PSA of 1.2, if that doctor had not done a digital rectal exam, I would not have known that I had cancer, because he would never have sent me to the doctor, to the biopsy, and so on and so forth. So the PSA in itself is not to be taken on its own. I come across mm-hmm. men frequently with very high PSAs and no cancer. And I equally come across men with low PSAs like mine, and they have cancer. So please do not take the PSA test as gospel as to whether you have cancer or not. The PSA is called prostate-specific antigen. Okay? And the first thing is, we know now it's not prostate-specific. In fact, women can test for a PSA in their breasts. And in fact, if you thump a man in his breast, his PSA will spike. It's a protein that is found elsewhere other than the prostate. But when Richard Albin discovered it back in 79, I think it was, all they knew is that it was from the PSA. That's why they called it prostate-specific antigen. And it no longer is that. So there's a lot of reasons to look, if you've got a high PSA, as to what's causing it. PSA only measures inflammation. It does not measure cancer.
That's really interesting and important point, Peter, because PSA has been a test that's like the gold standard for prostate health and prostate problems. And like you said, if it's low, most doctors and men would consider themselves, you know, good to go, and not realizing that it actually is not necessarily an accurate assessment of what's going on. And equally so, if it's high, it doesn't mean you're at risk of prostate cancer either. So that's really profound what you're sharing with us, and quite important for people to hear and understand.
Well, I'll give you another example. I had a patient come to me. I do consultations, and I had a I can't really call him a patient because I'm not an MD. We'll call him a client. Phoned me up and he said, I've got a PSA, it's 14.5. And the doctor said, I need to get a biopsy. And I've really heard bad things about biopsies. What do you think? And I said, well, there's no reason to get a biopsy right now. We need to do other things to determine whether a biopsy is even necessary. And I sent him for what's called a 3D color Doppler ultrasound, which is a very inexpensive ultrasound test that measures, amongst other things, blood flow. And you can see on a live television screen the prostate. You can see if there's any obvious lesions in the prostate. And you can measure the blood flow going to those lesions to determine whether it's live or dead. And if it's live and there are lesions in there, then the chances are that you perhaps have cancer. And then you've got to come to a choice and say, okay, am I going to treat this cancer naturally or alternatively, or am I going to treat it conventionally? Now, if you're going to treat it conventionally, they will do a biopsy. They will not treat you without one. But the side effects in the biopsy, including the spreading of the cancer, are real and significant. If you don't decide, if you decide not to do conventional treatment, but you're going to do natural treatment, then you've bypassed the problems of the biopsy and you can get on with your treatment. And you can look at it 2, 3, 4 months later and then see what's going on. And if you've had an improvement, you can see that through the 3D color Doppler ultrasound and perhaps do a PSA test as well in conjunction with that. There's also a test these days, by the way, called an oncoblot test, which is 100% accurate. It's a blood test. It's not cheap, unfortunately, and it's not available on insurance at the moment, as I know of, but it's foolproof. It's 100%. You do an oncoblot test, they'll tell you whether you've got prostate cancer or not. And that's a very big thing for a lot of men. Even though it's not insured, they'll spend the money for the peace of mind of knowing what they've got and where to go with it.
So let's talk about what – well, I just have a comment to make. Because I've written a book about women's health, and so, you know, obviously the role of estrogen with women's health. And I learned something really interesting, Peter, which you probably know. But the prostate is an estrogen-sensitive organ. And I think that shocks most people to know that if you are dealing with excess estrogens or exposure to xenoestrogens, you have high amounts of estrogen, you can't properly metabolize and deactivate the metabolites as they're detoxified. That actually is a driver for prostate cancer. And I'm sure you are aware of that as well.
Well, I can add to that, if I may. Men with prostate cancer, as a general rule, are testosterone deficient By that, I mean free testosterone deficient and estrogen dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. when you say that to a man, they freak out because they think, oh, I'm becoming a woman. I don't have testosterone. My libido is gone or blah, blah, blah. But in reality, it has very little to do with your libido because you're measuring free testosterone. And as you know, when they measure a total testosterone, most of that testosterone is bound to other proteins and is therefore ineffective in doing the job that testosterone needs to do. Men with a lot of testosterone do not get prostate cancer. Young men don't get prostate cancer, mm-hmm. and they've got an overflow of testosterone. So testosterone mm-hmm. isn't the problem. Estrogen is the problem. And when the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, which is a real issue. So somebody's just beeping me there, but it'll go away in a minute. I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We didn't hear it on our end. So
okay.
that's a really important point and very profound, which we can talk about. You know how well we'll talk about many strategies that are available for men. So, what strategies did you use? What did you, in your research, find to be the key to helping you on your healing journey?
Well, this it's a four-prong thing that I still teach today, but I didn't learn it all at once, so I didn't enact it all at once. When I started out, it was a journey. I knew nothing, and everywhere I learned from different doctors what their thoughts were, and I compiled what I'd learned from all of these things. So when I first started, I had no idea what to do or where to go. I read every book I could lay my hands on to make sure that I wasn't committing some sort of suicide by not doing conventional treatment. And after I'd probably into it about 3 months, I decided that I wasn't going to commit suicide by not doing what they told me to do, and that I actually had an opportunity to lead a very healthy life. And it's been now 16 years since I was diagnosed, and I'm still kicking, you know what, and you know, very, very active still. And so I believe I made the right decision. And but it took, when I talk to the men today, they come to it for a consultation. I say, here's the four things that you need to do. And you can start now by doing all of them. I couldn't do that because I didn't have all that information at the time. So I took it on one little bit at a time. I was a vegetarian for a short while. Realized that vegetarianism isn't the make all and be all of whether I'm going to get cancer or not, or certainly prostate cancer. So I just introduced fish back into my diet. I'm still primarily a vegetarian. I do eat fish. I do eat chicken, but not in great amounts. I've reduced the amount of protein that I take in compared to the amount of protein that I used to have. That is for sure. So I did change my diet, but I didn't change it that radically. I stopped eating fast food totally. I don't eat hamburgers or I don't eat any fast food whatsoever. I don't drink dairy. I don't have dairy food. I don't have ice cream. I don't drink milk. I totally cut dairy food out of my diet. Occasionally, I'll have a little cheese, but usually it's for flavor, not for volume of food that I'm eating. Those are the main things I changed in the very beginning, because that's where the first lessons that I learned from people was about diet. And so I put that into my system. What we do today is I recommend that a patient take what's called a functional blood analysis. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the term functional blood analysis, but essentially we test about 62 elements in the blood, and we look at what the body's actually doing. And the difference between a conventional laboratory blood analysis and a functional blood analysis, I can best illustrate if I use the example of vitamin D3. Now, vitamin D3, which is something we'll get into in a minute as a next stage, but when you take a normal blood test at any laboratory, the range that the laboratory will give you is between 20 and 100. And so if you're 25 or 30, your doctor will tell you, oh, you're okay, you're within the range. But in fact, you're not. You are deficient in D3 if you're under 30. In fact, you need to be between 50 and 70 on that same nanogram per milliliter scale. And if you're not, that's one of the reasons you have cancer. That's one of the contributing elements. Now, that middle measurement of between 50 and 70 is the functional range in which the body operates best. So if you're in the laboratory range, the doctor can say, oh, you're okay, you're at 30. In reality, you're not. You need to be in the functional range. And that's a range that's effective with all of the elements that the conventional laboratories use. They use a much broader range of what's good and what's bad versus the functional range, which is where the body relates to it for maximum efficiency.
And if I can just jump in, because that's such an important point, that is the point you just made, that range between 50 or 70 or even a little higher, is critical to prevent all chronic illnesses, including viruses and this COVID thing. You have to have an optimal vitamin D range. You cannot accept anything under 50 as normal, which is often what doctors will tell people. You know, you're, as long as you're within that reference range of 20 to whatever, if you're 25, you're good. No, as you were saying, that's not true. So it's really important to be able to take your vitamin D test and make sure, I always tell people, when your doctor says, yeah, you're good, don't accept that comment. You have to actually have a copy of the test and see what the number is. And if it's not at least 50, then you need to increase your vitamin D levels immediately. Because all cancers actually can be mitigated through optimal vitamin D levels.
Well, the vitamin D issue is huge. And one of the other fallacies about vitamin D is that you can actually get toxic from excessive vitamin D. In reality, in the tests that have been done, it's extremely difficult to become vitamin D3 toxic. They reckon you have to take about 60 milligrams per day for a year to become toxic. That's the best number that I've come across in terms of doctors that I've spoken to that really know what they're talking about. So don't be afraid of taking, you know, when you need it, 10,000 units. 400 units, as recommended by the American standards, is woefully inadequate,
Yeah.
And particularly during the winter. I mean, it's not so bad if you live in Southern California during the summer where you're getting a lot of sunshine, you know, but if you live in New Jersey or Boston or elsewhere and you're in the winter for 6 months of the year, you need to make sure you're getting, you know, adequate amounts of D3. There's another interesting statistic.
Absolutely.
There is a differential in terms of the diagnosis of prostate cancer, and it's a latitudinally differential. People that live closer to the equator have less incidence of prostate cancer than people that live in Canada, as an example. So if you live in San Diego, you have a much less chance of getting prostate cancer than you do if you live in Boston.
And what do they reckon that's related to?
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D levels?
Yeah.
And exposure to sunshine?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, what else? What's the next point on your protocol?
There's lots of issues. There's lots of issues in this functional blood analysis. And it takes a trained physician to diagnose the results, to tell you where you're going to go from there. I don't get into that because I'm not a doctor. I don't have an MD. I don't practice medicine. So what I do through my foundation here and through the practice that I have is to direct people to the best sources. So if they want to go through this, then I try to hook them up with a doctor that understands the whole functional medicine paradigm and get them to go there. I just become the leader to lead them to the right place. The second thing we do, we take a look at toxicity. And there are four heavy metals that play a part in prostate cancer, and that's nickel, lead, cadmium, and mercury. We all know where the mercury generally comes from. It's from, say, from the amalgams in your mouth. The rest are all environmental heavy metals that we get through what we do, where we live, how we live our lives. Now, I'm not saying that every incidence of prostate cancer has all of those heavy metals in there. What I'm saying is There's a preponderance of evidence to that end. And it needn't be all four of them. It could be just mercury as an example. Or it could be, if you deal with the automobiles, it could be nickel and cadmium, because there's a lot of nickel and cadmium in automobiles these days. So it could be any one of those, and they need to be detoxified. They need to be gotten out of the prostate, because they're creating the inflammation which eventually created the cancer, if you have cancer. Now, if you don't have cancer and you still have high PSAs, and you may have prostatitis or simply BPH caused by heavy metal toxicity, it still pays to have a detoxification done to get rid of those heavy metals if you find that they're there. And there are tests they can do to figure that out. There are several tests that a doctor will do to determine how much lead, nickel, mercury, or cadmium are in your system, and other things as well, but those are the key ones. So understanding the toxins that can affect prostate cancer and understanding that it's important to get them from your body. It's also important when it comes to mercury to get rid of amalgam fillings out of your mouth and put in the much less damaging composite fillings if you need fillings. And it certainly pays to not have root canals. Root canals can continue toxicity within your mouth. And we found out, and it was a case with me also, I had a root canal in my right front upper tooth, and it had gone bad. And the minute we pulled that out and cleaned it out and did not put anything back in was the time that I saw a definite change in my own personal health. And that was back in 2005, a year after I started studying, was when I had that tooth removed and started that healing. And it's very, very important to keep your mouth clean, as you well know, I'm sure, that people with the highest amounts of disease usually have a pretty poor mouth, gum damage and so on.
Yes,
so
because... And I just want to add to that, because when you have infection in your mouth, particularly in your bone, and when you have a root canal, there's a high risk, just because of the traditional way that root canals are done, by which is a dead tooth, and they try to plug it up. But it's live tissue that goes dead, and so this necrotic tissue that remains in your mouth, in your jawbone, actually is profoundly weakening your immune system, because it's like this constant response to try to get rid of this dead tissue which is locked inside your jaw. So that's why root canals can potentially pose a really serious problem, and many biological dentists don't even do root canals anymore because they see that connection.
It's absolutely true. In fact, if anybody wants to read more about that, Hal Huggins, I think, pretty much wrote the definitive work on a healthy mouth. And there's another doctor that unfortunately isn't with us any longer either, called Harold Ravins, that also was very instrumental in teaching what we now call biological dentistry. And he taught it at USC Dental School some now 40 years ago, and was actually pretty much asked to leave because they didn't want to teach that at USC Dental School. And he went out and set up his own practice after that. But he and Hal Huggins were both on it very, very early on. And there's another gentleman back east whose name I can't think of right this second. It'll come to me in a while. That is also was a leading person in having a healthy, clean mouth. The third thing we deal with is something that I know you're very familiar with, and that's hormone balance. As we've said previously, men with prostate cancer generally have high estrogen and deficient free testosterone, and that needs to be balanced. We do that. I'd personally like to see the testing done on a 24-hour basis I'm losing my brain here for a second.
Saliva testing.
Yeah. We do use blood testing, but it's only for a quick momentary look at it. I much prefer to do it over 24 hours. And I know, for instance, that Jonathan Wright, who's a clinic in Seattle, Tahoma Clinic, they like to use urine testing for that. Both are very good. He seems to get better results with urine testing. We like saliva testing, but occasionally we'll use blood for a quick analysis. But it's not something we base an entire treatment on. And the fourth thing we tell people is that one of the biggest issues with chronic disease generally, and certainly with men with prostate cancer, is what we call resolving emotional traumas. You'd be amazed at how many men have buried emotional traumas within their system for decades. And when they get to the point of having cancer, whether it's prostate or otherwise, their emotional life is a mess. And I believe totally that the minute you can turn your life around for disease, once you learn to understand that there are certain unresolved emotional traumas in your system that you need to resolve. And there are ways of doing that. I don't do it personally, but I can send people to people that do it and do it well, and I've had it done. So I've seen the difference personally, but as I say, I don't practice it. But I think it's incredibly important. It not only cleans your mind and helps your immune system that way, but it changes your attitude towards life. I'll give you a quick example for me personally. With being in the business that I was in, and particularly being a stunt person, I had a very short temper. If somebody cut me up on the freeway, if I had a 45-millimeter cannon in the front of my car, I'd have blown them out of the water. That's the edge that I lived on for many years. And the minute I went through a thing called recall healing with a doctor in Canada that I went through it with, that changed. It absolutely changed me so much that I could feel a change in my body. And that's just not the only thing he found out about emotional factors that he thought were affecting my life. And he made me face them and resolve them, and they were no longer a problem. But I didn't know about these until I got diagnosed, if you like, by this doctor in Canada. And Gilbert Renaud is his name, by the way. Gilbert is Gilbert in English. He's French-Canadian. And Renaud, R-E-N-A-U-D, a great guy. And Michelle Lamasser is another one that practices. She's now in Texas. She used to be in California. And it can be quite remarkable, the difference. And I think that's so important in getting the pressure off your body that these unresolved emotional traumas are causing, and allow your immune system to do what it's designed to do without taking a big chunk of it off to resolve your emotional problems. So that's the fourth issue that we talk about.
I want to acknowledge you for the work that you've done on healing that, and to reinforce what you're saying. You know, as a psychotherapist and also a naturopathic doctor, I have really delved into understanding root causes. I'm really fascinated by root causes, right? And one of the things that's just so profound for me in understanding what drives chronic issues, and I would say the primary thing would be unresolved emotional issues, because the stress of dealing with an emotional trauma that generates inappropriate reactions and emotions that are stimulated all the time, because if we have an emotional trauma, which could happen at birth, I did a lot of work with birth trauma, so it can go way back. And we don't even have any conscious memory of what it is and why we're triggered. But that creates such an ongoing stress. It's like having a thorn in your finger festering all the time that has ramifications and weakening the immune system and causing us undue pain until we can remove it. And I think that's a primary piece of healing any chronic illness. And that's what I've witnessed. And I've worked with psychotherapy, I've worked with hypnotherapy, I work with frequency medicine, I work with all sorts of things that can actually do exactly what you were saying, is help a person resolve the wound or the misperception that was created at some point in life, generally early on in life, that is unconsciously driving our stress response and weakening our immune system and setting ourselves up for something down the track.
You've made a very good analogy there, and I'm going to use it if you don't mind. Is that is having a thorn that has festered and continues to fester until you take the thorn out. I think that's a very good analogy to tell somebody just what an unresolved emotional trauma is doing to you. And I might also mention, by the way, that another system that I found has done different people good is German New Medicine. I've mm-hmm. personally not found it as effective as recall healing. That's a personal thing. But I do know people that have done it, and I do know people for which it's been very successful. So I also want to give them a mention as well. If people are looking, well, they may say, well, there's no recall healing person near me, and but there's a GM, a GNM person close by. Will that do? Yes, it will. It all depends upon how you go into the system and how you go into the to the treatment. There's another system called Psy-K, which I have not, I've been through it. I haven't found it to be specifically helpful for the release of the disease of the traumas of the cancer that I was dealing with. But I also found it to be very, very good in terms of dealing with people with deep-rooted emotional traumas. And the other thing is, of course, get rid of the stress in your life. If you're in a bad relationship, get rid of it. If you're in a bad marriage, get rid of it or fix it. You know, but don't continue the stress, as you pointed out so eloquently, is that thorn in it that's festered. And as long as you keep that thorn in there, it's going to continue to fester. And, boy, we all know people who are in bad relationships and have been in them for a long time.
And you know, in continuing this conversation, relationships are the places where all our wounds get activated. So it's really important to understand if we want to resolve an if we want to resolve a stress or pain in a relationship, the highest option would be for both partners to go in and do the work that removes the emotional wound that is activated in the relationship. And I've had some wonderful guests, and Dr. Harville Hendricks is one of them, that is just, his work is understanding how to create peace by healing the wounds that come from our childhood and reactivated. The other thing I want to say, Peter, and since we're on the subject of emotional wounds, is the challenge, particularly for men, is the fact that they actually do have to go in and acknowledge that they have emotional wounds. Because the programming for men in our culture, of course, is to suppress our emotions. In fact, the male energy in general does not easily access emotions, you know, other than anger. that's an easy one. But, it, you know, yeah. Men are mostly the intellect, not the emotion. Women are much, you know, it's innate for women to be more emotional. It's not so easy for men, and because of the vulnerability issues and just because they're not ever taught that it's okay to feel.
Yeah, well,
and I'm sure
also,
it was
yeah.
for you, because I was going to say, you know, your career as a stuntman, I mean, you had to be tough macho all the time.
Well, it's certainly when I was doing what I was doing, absolutely. And so it's before that, I was a film director and maker, made a lot of documentary films, and it wasn't the case so much then, but it certainly was during the years that I was doing my stunt work. And I was an old stunt guy. I literally, I was 59 when I finally had the accident that put me out of business. And I started doing stunt work when I was about 49. And I did it and got into it because of my ability to ride a motorcycle. And when they were doing Lethal Weapon 3 with, I forget the actor's name that was in that thing, the Australian guy. But anyway, Mel Gibson. Yeah, that was it. They asked me, did I still have a particular motorcycle that I had? I said, yes. They said, would you like to come and double Mel Gibson and in this motorcycle chase thing? And that was the start of a career for me. And I went to many, many movies and many TV commercials. And you're right. It's when you're in that environment, you know, you've got to be hard. You've got to be steel hard to what you're doing and to the people around you. And so I acknowledge that that may have caused some issues with me in the way that the cancer formed in those 9 years that I was doing that. And I think one of the triggers for it was the amazing accident that I had that ended that career. And they reckon that when you, from the day that you are diagnosed with a cancer, if you go back 3 to 4 years and look for one single emotional issue during that time, that's a causation issue. And for me, it had to be the accident at the end of 9 years of stunt work, in my opinion. And I learned that from an Australian doctor, actually. But I've asked many, many people, look back 3-4 years from the date of diagnosis, what were you doing? And they can put their fingers on something almost every time. Not always, but almost every time. And
Was that traumatic? Was that traumatic for you?
Oh yes, my accident was incredibly traumatic.
What was traumatic?
I couldn't work
about it for you.
My right leg was broken in 5 places. They couldn't fix it with one surgery. They had to take 2 surgeries within a month apart. So I was in the hospital at home, literally living on a couch, with my leg in the air. Back in the hospital, back in doing it, and it was 6 months before I could even do any work on it whatsoever to get back to being fit. And by that time, my leg had atrophied. It was like just bone. It was disgusting to look at. I had to build all that back up, and that whole experience was unbelievably traumatic. Just the accident itself, to be quite honest, it was traumatic. It came out of nowhere, you know, really. But I just thought of the other doctor, the other dentist I wanted to mention. That's William Donald Kelly, who's a dentist that's done a lot of work. I think he passed away not so long ago, of a ripe old age of 90-some-odd. But he wrote an awful lot about the relationship between dentistry and cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know I think of his name if I was here long enough for that.
That's what happens. It definitely comes back. So what else is that we haven't touched on yet? Sure.
Well, there's not much we actually haven't touched on except in real detail. I mean, people ask me what I take zinc, for example. Zinc is very important for the prostate. I never took it before. I do now. I still have my prostate, by the way, and it still seems to be functioning normally. I take iodine because we are iodine deficient for the most part. I take selenium and boron, but I'm getting to think as I'm getting into this that the selenium isn't as important as the boron. I have no data on this yet, but it's just something that I'm noticing from my own taking of it. D3, of course, I take, particularly when I'm not. If I'm out in the sun during the day, I don't take any because I'm probably getting, 30,000 units by being out in the sun during the day. Whereas if during the winter, like with no sunshine now, I might take anywhere from 10 to 15,000 units a day. Amino acids. Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go.
Amino acids are very important. There's a company in Canada called Immune Systems Management that does an amino acid analysis as it relates to the disease you have. And then they will put together a composite of amino acids for you to fulfill the negative part of your amino acid profile. And I did that in the very beginning, and I think it had a great effect on the speed that I made my recovery. And it's not cheap, unfortunately, and it's certainly not available on insurance. They're based in Ottawa, Canada. But if anybody has got severe prostate cancer and they want to do a natural approach and they've got the financial resources, then I would certainly take a look at Immune Systems Management and look at their amino acid program.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
It's all very individual because, there are so many amino acids that we have, both essential and non-essential, and until you see where you're deficient and where you might have too much, you don't know what composite they're going to put together for you. So you have to have the analysis done first, and then they'll recommend what to do after that.
And I would recommend 2 other things, which you probably already incorporate. One of them is probiotics, because our hormones actually are generated initially by a healthy microbiome in our gut. People don't know that. But the healthy microbiome plays a major role in proper hormone production. So and immune health and so many other functions. So I always think supporting a healthy gut and a good probiotic formula can help do that, especially if you've damaged your gut.
Well, I couldn't agree more. The only thing I would add to that is the fact that there are so many people selling, quote, probiotics. I tend to get people to go for those that are fresh, that need to be refrigerated, not the ones that are sort of packaged and on the shelf for 3 months before you get them. If you're sick and you've got cancer, you need the best probiotic you can get, not just any probiotic. You know, do some shopping for it is what I tell people.
Yeah, like anything, you need to find a good source. One other thing I want to include, we talked about the role of estrogen with prostate cancer, and one of the areas that I have researched and found to be really important for men as well as for women is to use broccoli seed extract product or sulforaphane. It metabolizes into sulforaphane because broccoli seed extract or just eating a lot of cruciferous vegetables, but can never be therapeutic dose just getting vegetables. The sulforaphanes or the broccoli seed extract actually supports proper estrogen metabolism through the liver. So you are reducing the toxic estrogen load in your body, which is always, as we said earlier, connected to prostate cancer and other estrogen-sensitive cancers. So I don't know if you use a broccoli seed extract, but anyway,
I agree with you. I use a thing called cruciferous vegetable. It's put out by Life Extension, and that's how I supplement. I eat a lot of vegetables, but that's how I supplement the cruciferous vegetables to make sure that I'm getting enough of that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So, kind of coming to the end of our time together, and I want to be sure people know that your book is available, Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, or Radiation, which, you know, it's like the Bible. It's obviously a profound book, in-depth research, and, of course, you have gone through it, and you're passionate about this. People have to get educated, and as always, do your research. Do not rush into any invasive procedure within 48 hours of getting this diagnosis. You have time. You have time. How long does it take for prostate cancer to develop? Several years at least, I would say.
Oh, yes. Yes, generally speaking. I tell people, you know, they come to me and they're freaking out because they're panicked. And I'm going, you're not going to die of prostate cancer tomorrow. This is not pancreatic cancer. You know, you've got time to think it through. You've got time to get a second, third opinion. You've got a time to go to a lot of different sources. But the main thing is panic adds to the problem, as it does with any disease. If panic is what adds to the stress of life, and the stress increases the severity of the disease. So, you know, I know it's hard to relax. When the doctor tells you you've got cancer, we have been conditioned to, we hear the C word and it's like, I'm going to die and I'm going to die tomorrow. I mean, that's what our system is telling us because we've been programmed that for so long. And if the doctor would say to you something to the effect, you know, we've spotted a tumor inside the prostate there. We think we need to take a look at this or we need to do this or that in a much more calm and collected and friendly way. But no, my doctor called me up on the phone and he says, yep, you've got cancer. I want you to read this book by Patrick Walsh. They come in and see me and hung up. 8 seconds I timed it, was when he's on the phone. And of course, what happened to me? I freaked out. I lay in bed for 2 days. I had stomach pains. I was going to die. And all the problems of life came out. And there was no need for that. No need whatsoever for that. And it galls me when I hear that going on to this day, when men call me up and they're put through that stress by the very same doctor that's supposed to not put them through that kind of stress. it's
and,
an irony.
And,
that,
and, I have worked with people. I've worked with people who've also chosen a more natural way to work with prostate cancer, and it cannot be stated enough that the traditional approach in treating prostate cancer through surgery, removing the prostate, or through whatever, chemotherapy, is disastrous for the quality of life for men. And as you said, it can cause incontinence. You can lose your ability to have a sexual erection. I mean, it's devastating for the quality of life of men. So this is what goes along with the territory if you do some of those invasive procedures. And to know, like with most cancers, if you're willing to do the work and unravel that journey that has brought you there and start making the changes, the body has the capacity to heal anything. And you're such an inspiration, Peter. I just want to say and thank you for the journey you've been on and your graciousness in sharing what you've been learning and putting together documentaries and now your new book and your website, survivingprostatecancer.org, so you can share your journey and your wisdom and the resources you've gathered along the way with men and their families to give them more knowledge and more power and more choices.
Let me say one thing to close, if I may, about women. Women, wives, girlfriends, or whatever, can play such a significant role in the way men think about their disease. Men tend to be a bull at a gate kind of personality. Women can be a very calming figure if they choose to be and help that man become calmed and help him make a choice that's going to be right for them rather than a choice that's going to be right for the doctor. I'll leave you with that.
Great words of wisdom. So thank you so much for your time today. I encourage everyone pick up the book, Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, or Radiation. Go to survivingprostatecancer.org. It's always best to be educated and empowered before something happens. So just gain your resources and gain more knowledge. And all the best to you, Peter, and the great work you're doing. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Likewise, Cheryl. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're so welcome. Bye for now. And for everyone listening, thank you for joining me for another opportunity to have these wonderful and important in-depth conversations. I hope you'll be joining me every week. Remember, just go over to my Facebook page, What Women Must Know, like me there, or Dr. Cheryl Selman, opt-in. And I'll be back again next week with another empowering conversation. So until then, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.